Thank you very much. Well, it's great to be here tonight, and it's very nice to come very close to the end of my first year at Mason with this reading, so I'm really pleased about it. I'm actually going to read tonight from some new work. It's a story that just came out in the Missouri Review. Can everybody hear me? Pretty much, yeah. I don't have much luck with these. There, okay. And this is a story that's called Gathering Up the Little Gods. She has always loved motion. When her legs stride beneath her and her hands cut the air, she imagines the muscle and bone that produce her forward movement. She pictures them like a diagram from Gray's Anatomy, a copy of which she keeps on her bookshelf at home. She walks when she is content or hungover, or when she wakes up to find the street below her apartment an ugly gray. She walks until her lower back aches so that it matches the rhythm of her heart. Up through the city she goes, and when she arrives at her studio, she paints the yellow of cabs careening past her and the slide of white clouds in the sky. She absorbs these movements, and the people she passes in blurs of color and the downward slant of rain, then releases them again. She makes her canvases shake. If Elsbeth has imagined growing sick at all, she has thought that lethargy would be the worst part. She has visited homes for the elderly, hospitals where people are attached to beds and chairs by plastic tubing. She has always been claustrophobic in those places, and breathe through her mouth in order to avoid the smell of Lysol and of piss. Is it summertime? She can remember a bedridden aunt asking her in Polish when she was a child. Her name had been something like Jadwiga or Halina, and she had wanted to go down to the river and swim. It will be most enjoyable, the old woman kept insisting through that visit, as snow fell in great white chunks on the other side of the hospital window. Today, Elspeth is sitting across from a doctor in another hospital in another decade, but she thinks suddenly of that aunt's papery skin and white hair like a dandelion's halo. She remembers her own mother glancing meaningfully at the nurse, then asking the aunt gently, "Which river?" And the old woman hadn't answered, but looked troubled by this question, as if she herself would like to know. There are aggressive therapies, the doctor tells Elsbeth now. You're young and otherwise healthy. Had that aunt died then, she wonders? She cannot remember a wake or a funeral, though there were several in her childhood. She tries but cannot see the woman lying waxen in a box or her photograph on top of a coffin at Gray's funeral home. She cannot even remember the name. Christina, perhaps it was Christina. Is that what happens before we die, she thinks now? We forget the names of rivers where we have swum? The doctor is looking at her expectantly, as if he has asked a question and is waiting for her response. She nods and he begins again. She has told nobody about the tests, not her parents who live modestly in their leafy corner of Queens, not the friends she meets for drinks and movies and dinners, not the ex-boyfriend with whom she still sometimes sleeps, but amicably and without regret. "This is unusual for me," she had confessed to him only the month before. "Lingering makes me uncomfortable." The thing, too, has had momentum. The specialist says it has been growing inside her for some time. It has mated with itself and produced babies. 2 weeks ago, he called the test a precaution and pierced her throat with a needle 5 times, the stainless steel making her skin burn. He told her not to swallow until he was done, and she watched the ceiling above her. She had turned down the anesthetic because it cost more, and afterward, they joked about the Mets. In the intervening weeks, she had forgotten about the tests. They were certainly the furthest thing from her mind this morning when her clock radio played a song at 8:30 a.m. and light streamed through her window. She sliced a banana into cornflakes, brewed coffee, brushed her teeth. She listened to the news headlines, then looked through her notebook, annoyed to find the doctor's appointment at 11 o'clock. She decided to pick up the test results on the way to her studio, a dusty space in Spanish Harlem where she is working on a triptych, three canvases which will show centrifugal force. She had hoped that this interruption would not impede her ambitions for that day. But now, she sits across from the doctor, who is saying something about white blood cells. She tells herself, "Stupid, stupid girl." She cuts him off. "What can I expect?" But he thinks she is asking about procedures, which tests are next, when really she is asking him about motion. So that when she leaves the hospital, she jaywalks wildly down to the financial district and runs across the Brooklyn Bridge, the wooden ramp shuddering beneath her. It is winter, and only a handful of people brave the cold. They are shapeless and lumber along slowly, buried beneath layers of coats and scarves. Just after the second tower, a bird swoops down onto the giant suspension cable in front of her, and she slows. Her ears ache from the cold, and when she doubles over, the pain in them grows so sharply outward that her mind clears of anything else. When she straightens, the bird sits on the cable, watching her. She is 30, and she has never been seriously ill. She has had her share of broken bones and flus, and she was mildly asthmatic as a child. But she has never stayed in a hospital, never elicited such a guarded reaction from a nurse. "Dr. Walker needs to give you the test results in person. That's our policy." Her mother and her father were always telling her to wear a sweater, to shut doors and windows to prevent drafts. When she was a child, it had annoyed her, but her parents came from Poland, where tuberculosis cut the landscape. "I was so frightened when I came here, my Elżbieta," her mother had told the story several times, "so frightened that they would see the shadow on my lung." "Na zdrowie," her father says when he touches his vodka glass to hers on Sunday as her mother ladles out steaming bowls of soup. "To health." She is their first and only child. She visits them on a weekly basis and listens as they mourn the street crime, which they believe to be on a perpetual rise in Queens, the price of fish, the behavior of taxi drivers. "Shameful," her mother tells her in the kitchen. "And we were coming back from church." And she has been a strange kind of daughter to them. No husband, no children. "There will be none now," she thinks glumly. No diploma from a fancy school behind a perfect rectangle of glass. "Art school?" her father's brother had said, shaking his head in stupefaction when she was 22. "Who goes to art school? A degree in law is what you want." But her parents show up to her art shows in their Sunday clothes, her father's shoes polished so that she can look down at them and see her reflection, her mother wearing an amber necklace that is a last vestige of the North Sea. They weave through the gatherings, the people with piercings and ironic thrift store clothing, and they smile roundly like two Polish Buddhas, and she grins to see them move in tandem, stand before her canvases, and nod their heads. "Although the cancer has spread, didn't you feel any pain in your stomach?" the doctor asks. She is young and otherwise healthy. These are the descriptions she will hear again and again as she goes from one specialist to the next, as if they are working on an identical script. In the final doctor's office, as a joke, she writes them under medical history. "What's this?" he asks in a slightly annoyed tone when he flips through her chart. "Except that it has spread, and the things babies have had their own babies, and she is 30 and without health insurance. Although she occasionally sells a painting and teaches art classes for rent, she barely has the money to pay for the tests, and certainly not for the combination of chemo and radiation they suggest." "But surely you must have help from somewhere," one of the insurance coordinators asks her, "and there are some forms of assistance." Elsbeth sits across the table from this woman, blinking dumbly. Insurance coordinator. Before, she had not even known that such a term existed, and now the woman is asking her about her assets, of which there are none. What about family members, she presses, looking squarely at Elspeth, who notices that her eyes are perfectly encircled in black, as if the woman had spent hours standing at a mirror this morning, drawing and erasing those lines. Her parents will mortgage their house if they discover it. They will take the money they have put aside for their retirement, and so Elspeth decides not to tell them. During this time, the three canvases lie to the side in her studio, and ideas for new projects founder before she can even sketch their outlines. She resolves to spend her days making the rounds of galleries, taking an exhibit so that the time is not wasted. But these ideas also are stillborn, and some days she does not get out of bed and barely registers when one television show ends and another begins. There follows a week in which she walks obsessively, every day from first light until it is dark. One evening, she finds a dead pigeon in the street and picks it up. She cradles it in her hands and decides to take it to her studio, where she lays newspaper on a table and places the pigeon on top. Its body is stiff and heavier than she would have presumed. She wonders how long it has been dead, whether it was moving only hours ago. "Well?" she asks the bird, her cheeks flushed. She feels a trickle of sweat between her breasts and loosens the scarf at her neck. She hunts around the studio for a sharp knife that has not been blunted by gesso or paint and finds a box cutter in a drawer. She had been good at biology. She dissected a frog as other girls in her Catholic high school squealed in horror and delight around the table. Now she holds her breath as she cuts the wing free from the bird and pulls it between her trembling hands, opening it like an accordion and letting it close again. She looks closely and realizes that there are tiny feathers of exotic color that rest in the elbow. Do birds have elbows? She wonders. But it is the mechanics of the thing that concerns her as she stands intently over the table with the box cutter still in her hand. She pulls out the feathers so that she can examine the interlocking bone and sinew. She unwraps the bird like a present. There is one small window in the studio, but she does not notice when the sky grows light outside or when it begins to rain. She does not even notice the bird that sits on the ledge, some breathing cousin of the thing in front of her, and spreads its wings and disappears from sight. She unplugs her answering machine, without bothering to listen to the recorded messages, 17 at last count. She leaves telephone messages for her close friends, deliberately picking times when she knows that they will not be home. "I'm going deep into this project," she tells them. "You may not hear from me for a while." She finds a sooty mouse in a corner of a subway station, a collection of moths between her bedroom window and screen, several more birds in Central Park. One afternoon, she even finds a squirrel, which an unleashed dachshund drags in its mouth. "Drop it," she hisses, and the dog looks at her in shock, then does as it is told, and runs in the opposite direction. The squirrel is not dead yet. It convulses in her hands, and she waits. She strokes its tail until its feet stop their imaginary running. In those days, she copies the tracery of the moth's wings, the mouse's slender tail. "We are intricate machines," she tells the squirrel, "nothing less and nothing more." In recent years, there has been a trend of exhibits with human corpses. The bodies are flayed and dissected and unclothed through the strategic placement of plexiglass. The exhibits had never interested her for the precise reason they shocked others. They rendered the human body inanimate. "So what?" she had told a friend, standing before a jar in which a fetus floated with a look of surprise in its alien eyes. The projects on which she is working are for her own benefit, and she works into the early morning hours, sketching her charges and the mechanics of their movements. She draws their wings, their lungs, their hearts on white paper. She dips their paws in ink and leaves footprints over the floor of her studio. They go up the walls at right angles. They defy gravity and leave trails upon the ceiling. The radiator in her studio is broken, and she perspires as she works, removing layers of clothing until finally she is working in her underwear, her sock feet padding silently across the floor. It is as she considers her menagerie of wings, from pigeons, sparrows, and crows, that she catches sight of her own reflection in a piece of glass on the opposite wall. She swings her arm again, watches the muscle pull taut beneath her skin. She repeats the movement several times. I think I'll stop there. Thanks very much.